I was a little bit concerned that it might be, you know, a destructive conversation if it wasn't adequately informed. I was particularly concerned about sentiment targeting trans women in particular, which really for us wasn't an issue because, you know, if you say you're a woman, you could play. But it was more of a problem for people who said they weren't women anymore. And so what I did at the time is I started a research project to find out what other lesbian softball leagues in North America were doing. And I found that most hadn't really adopted any policy, but that there was a league in San Francisco that had, and that it was a policy. It had both a women's softball program and a open softball program. And what they decided was that trans people could play in either of those divisions, depending on where they felt the most comfortable. So, you know, I interviewed a lot of league executives to do that. And then in subsequent work, I interviewed transgender participants in lesbian softball leagues to see how it was going. So that was kind of where I got started, focusing on transgender issues. And then when I became a parent in 2005, I was horrified at how much effort people were putting into telling my children who they were, what they liked, etc., based on the gender everyone presumed them to be. And, you know, that resonated for me because, you know, I'm trans myself. I've, you know, been queer for a really long time. But when I grew up, it was just unthinkable to, like, being trans was not an option. I'd never even heard of it. It wasn't a thing. And, it, you know, I couldn't even imagine ever being openly queer. Like, it just, you know, I was born in the 60s. It was so different. But I started doing research about how children and families of children were negotiating gender, and it very quickly took me to transgender kids. And I started going to conferences for transgender kids and their families. I started interviewing parents of trans kids and interviewing trans kids themselves. So in 2018, I published a book called The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution, which at the time, you know, things seemed to be getting better, but obviously things have taken quite a marked turn for the worst. And I continue to do research with and on behalf of trans kids, and I continue to do a lot of public advocacy for trans kids.
I spoke with Dr. Melanie Gross, and she said that one of the things that really interested her, inspired her in her research here in Canada, in contrast to what she had witnessed in her time as a social worker in Germany, was your work and your focus on the role of parents in all of this. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, parents of trans kids as a social movement have done incredible things. I mean, queer and trans social movements have accomplished so much, you know, since I was born. But one of the things that I noted is that particularly white, heterosexual appearing moms could do the kind of work on behalf of transgender kids and transgender people that nobody else could do. I mean, like, some of the moms that I interviewed had gone into schools and trained staff on gender inclusive practices. You know, like, most of these moms, you know, they were lawyers or they were other professionals. They were very highly educated, really comfortable with navigating bureaucratic systems, and were not considered by anyone to be a threat to children. There's all the, you know, the lies that are spread about queer and trans people being a threat to children, which is ironically not accurate. It's actually white heterosexual men for the most part, but never mind. But yeah, I literally was quite impressed by what parents are able to do. And one of the things that I wanted to do in my book is push these parents to advocate for all trans kids, not just their white kids, not just the kids. Because I think in a lot of cases, these parents, it was the first time that they weren't able to pass on their privilege, and they were like, it was a shock. So for many, it was like their first experience with activism, whereas, you know, there are others who were like gender theorists and university professors who had a history with feminism and whatnot, but parents have played a huge, huge role. Now, understandably, parents, particularly in the United States and Alberta, are like freaking out, because their kids are vulnerable and they've got the government enacting policies that are an absolute threat to their kids' well-being, to their kids' existence. So I still think that parents of trans kids have so much potential to affect change that will benefit all trans people and all kids, really.
An interesting sort of model for allyship as well.
Yeah, I had a really funny experience about 10 years ago at the Gender Odyssey Conference in Seattle. Gender Odyssey is a conference. It's like it's got a two-part. It's for trans people and for trans kids and families of trans kids. And there are some collective events, and then there are some separate events because, you know, different things. But the keynotes were collective, and I looked around as a woman of color, a trans woman of color who had once been the president of San Francisco Pride, was up giving a keynote talking about her experience of being rejected by her family, of having to, you know, like engage in sex work to support herself, all that kind of stuff. And she was talking about really significant moments in LGBT history. And I'm looking around the room and I'm seeing a lot of, you know, white heterosexual couples. And when the speaker mentioned Stonewall, they were like all over it. And it's like they felt like this was their history because of their kids. And, you know, there was a part of me that was like a little weirded out. But then I was like, wow, what an incredible opportunity to radicalize people, which is what I tried to do with my book. It's like parents of trans kids are going to read my book because they read everything. And the message that I wanted to give them was, if you care about trans kids, you care about the trans kids who are undocumented, who need school lunch, who are homeless, who are immigrants, etc. Trans is not a single issue. Like, literally, every population of kids has trans kids in it, whether they make themselves visible or not. And one of the pieces of advice that I've been giving to groups of parents of trans kids now is to get involved in local government. And don't make trans your issue. Focus on every vulnerable child. Because if you are advocating for vulnerable children, their families who may not, you know, have gotten the trans thing before, but if they find that you are supporting their kids, like, they're going to be a lot more open to hearing about how protections for trans kids are important. Like, this is how you build coalition. So I still think there's a lot of potential there.
In your book, you're advocating for situating trans kids in Canada and US as being within sort of a white settler colonial context with significant social inequality. You've sort of touched on it already, but why is it important to do that?
Well, because being trans isn't a single issue. And it's also really important historically, because one of the things we know is that European colonizers worked really hard to eradicate gender and sexual diversity in indigenous populations. They were typically the people who were harmed the most. And we certainly saw with residential schools that children who were gender nonconforming or identifying in a way that was different than traditional sex binaries, they were treated very harshly. So there's this history of imposing a patriarchal and heteronormative form of family and kinship on Indigenous people. So that's really important to understand, that binary sex systems were considered to be marks of civilization. And not just binary, but gender inequality, like patriarchy, was male rule was considered to be the pinnacle of human development. And this was imposed on Indigenous peoples. And both Canada and the United States, their origin story is that of colonialism and white supremacy. So obviously with the system of chattel slavery that basically drove economic development in the United States, as well as the slave trade doing that in Europe. So the way in which race and gender are integrated with class, etc., location, these are really important dynamics. And as I've emphasized, I want people to understand that being trans is not a single issue politic, that people are many things in addition to being trans, and you can't address the needs or interests of trans people if you don't look at the experiences that racialized trans people have, that Indigenous people who defy simple binary categorization have. So it's all connected.
Right, and I think there's like a humanization element of it too, and that by not defining anyone by a single part of their identity, right? By recognizing people are complex and have lots of different things and lots of different opinions and lots of different needs and all of that.
And if you focus exclusively on a person being queer or trans, and you talk about queer and trans people, then typically you're talking about white and relatively wealthy queer and trans people. If you don't address the great variation among the trans population, then you tend to normalize the experience of the most privileged. you know, certainly when I was doing my research related to transgender kids, I mean, most of the trans kids that were being brought to people's attention in media, et cetera, were white and relatively wealthy, when in reality, most trans kids are not white and relatively wealthy, and most trans kids are invisible because they don't feel it's safe to show themselves. So I really wanted to counter this image of the trans kid with the parents who are lawyers and the kid is otherwise privileged, because that's not usually the case.
Right, the prevailing social image of the trans kid being just the ones who have the privilege to show up.
Yeah, and you know, the ones with the green hair and the blue hair. And I mean, it's wonderful. Those are great kids, but those are probably the most visible, but certainly not the most representative.
On April 9th, SFU's Department of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies is hosting the event 2S LGBTQI Plus Youth Challenges, Resilience, and Empowerment, where you will be a speaker. Can you give a little bit of an idea of what people might expect out of the event?
I haven't really thought about it too much, but I believe I have 10 minutes. I think my plan will be to emphasize the incredible diversity among transgender kids, trans and non-binary kids, to talk about the way in which a very well-organized and well-funded anti-trans campaign is seeking to literally erase trans people from history, to drive us back out of public life. I think that will be what I emphasize. I'll talk about some specific policies, what's been happening in Alberta, the policy in Saskatchewan, and the policy that was announced originally in New Brunswick, which forced teachers to out their queer and trans students to their families, which fortunately, when there was a provincial election, a conservative government was voted out of power, and one of the first things that the new premier announced was that she was rescinding that policy and that queer and trans youth would not be outed to their families against their wishes. You know, because obviously, like any teacher or school counselor, one of the first questions they're going to ask is, well, have you told your parents? Can I help you tell them? Right? Like, that's going to be the first thing that an adult will probably ask. And if the kid says, I'm afraid to tell my parents, or I haven't told them, and I think they'd kick me out, then imagine what would happen if the parent was informed that their kid was using a different pronoun. But like I said, most teachers and counselors, the first thing they're going to want to do is involve the parents.
So many of these government policies around gender identity, trans identity, seem to be focused on youth. Why do you think that is?
That's interesting. I think that until the emergence of these really hideous campaigns targeting transgender kids, I think it was easier to focus on transgender kids because they're kids and they're sort of less threatening. You know, like if you have a 6-year-old who is asserting a different gender identity, it's like, oh, okay. Like, you know, people are maybe less threatened. Whereas transgender adults, I mean, many trans adults did not have access to hormone blockers. So the gender nonconformity is something that most people have been socialized to fear and be uncomfortable around. But at the same time, my hope is that no body modifications are necessary for somebody to be accepted as the gender they are, but we're a very, very long way from that, especially like with the really deliberate spreading of propaganda and lies about trans people and the idea that trans children are sick and their parents are irresponsible for supporting them. It's like trans kids have been made into monsters in the popular imagination, you know, as a result of a really concerted campaign.
What are your hopes for queer youth?
You know, when I was writing my first book, I included this in the introduction, I noticed how I'd gotten to a point where I couldn't remember who anybody originally was. And I say originally was in quotes, meaning the sex assigned at birth. And I remember feeling like, I love this. This is where I want to get to. And when I interview kids, I do not ask them what sex they were assigned at birth. I ask them, you know, usually the first question is, how did you come to understand that your gender was different than the one that everybody else expected it was? That's the opening question. And I don't ask questions about what their body parts are or anything like that. Partly because it's none of my business. Like, it's really not anybody's business, but also because it's not important to me. I'm more concerned about, you know, how they're navigating life, the supports that they have been able to find, the supports that they haven't been able to find, those kinds of things. So I would like to get to a point where sex and gender did not organize our lives to the extent that they do. I find it really great the way in which some community centers, for example, have redesigned change rooms. Because there were problems all along of, you know, like families change room, like when are you not allowed to bring your, you know, your 6-year-old son in the women's change room? When are you not allowed to bring your 5-year-old daughter in the men's? Like, what do you do? Like, you know, the assumption is that it is a woman taking care of children all the time, but you know, even then, like, do you send your 8-year-old into the change room by himself?
What's the cutoff?
Well, yeah, and it depends on the kid. Like, you know, some 8-year-old would be like, ah! So rather than organize those facilities around gender, they've done these things like they've just sort of called them family change rooms or open, and they have more privacy. They have cubicles where families can change. They have showers, single-stall showers. And I think that that kind of makes everybody more comfortable. I mean, they still, like I'm thinking at my local community center, they still do have one area just for women and just for men, whatever. But, like, I think most people just use the family area, and it really seems to work. And, you know, my sort of fantasy of the world that I'd like to see youth navigate would be one where going to the bathroom, participating in physical activity, changing for sport, or any one of a number of things didn't require them to announce what their gender identity was, that they could just do the things that they wanted to do and needed to do, and they could go to the places where they wanted to go and needed to go to, and they wouldn't be bumping up against a disabling environment that was constantly trying to stream them off into one sex category versus another. Like, if you don't even have that to begin with, you eliminate crisis. You know, and one of the points that I often make is that the majority of trans kids are invisible. So anytime you're working with a group of kids or young people, there are trans people there. So even if you aren't aware that you're making it easier for trans kids by not organizing according to gender, there are kids in that group who are not being put in crisis by the organizational logic that is being imposed on them. That would be what I would like. I would like to see the organization of space and facilities be based on something other than sex, and also that everybody be properly trained in bathroom and change room etiquette. The assumption that binary-based washrooms and change rooms are therefore safe is just so bogus. What if kids, which we can do when they're starting in kindergarten, learned how do we treat each other when we're in the bathroom? What does it mean to, you know, acknowledge someone's privacy? All these kinds of things. Like, we could do that kind of work. But that's just sort of part of the world I want for trans youth. I want a world where no trans youth worries about where they're going to sleep that night, if they're going to be safe, if they're going to have enough food, those kinds of things. So, you know, the only way to make sure that all trans kids are okay is to make sure all kids are okay. And, you know, for me, it would be really simple. We could say, okay, Canada, here we are. What do we need to do to make sure that every possible child not only lives but thrives? Like, what if we made all our decisions on that basis? Or, you know, like the Middle East. What if we said, okay, what do we need to do to make sure that all the Palestinian kids and all the Jewish kids, they survive and they thrive? Like, that would be a completely different orientation to policymaking and decision making, like if that was the priority. So, you know, that's a very, very distant reality, but that is what I do want for trans kids.
Well, it seems like a reality that everyone should be able to agree on is the best for all kids, right? Regardless of what other politics or ideology or however else you see the world, if that's the focus, that should be easy enough to agree on. But here we are.
No. I mean, you know, there are people who, like, actively do not want the children of so-called undeserving people to thrive. And I think it's really disingenuous because there's so much, like the anti-trans movement is like they're concerned about children, just like the anti-trans women in sport were concerned about women's sports. No, they're not. They've never been concerned about women's sports, and they'll never be concerned about women's sports. They're just interested in targeting trans people. Most people would say, oh, yeah, like, you know, we should support kids, da, 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 but they don't, because when you look at the policies, that's not what's happening. I mean, we have a system in Canada where people are taxed below the poverty line. The government sets a poverty line, and then it taxes people below that. So the hypocrisy is just so ridiculous.
Well, hopefully events like the one on April 9th can start conversations around these ideas and maybe lead to solutions, to progress, to movement.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think, like, when my book came out in 2018, I did a lot of media. Like, I did, like, 65 radio interviews in the States in a month or something, and I did some in Canada as well. And I think subsequent to that, that was, like, 7 years ago, there's been, you know, this massive, massive rise in anti-trans propaganda and policymaking. And I just think, I hope that I was able to inoculate some listeners so that, you know, if even a few people, when they start hearing, they go, you know, that just doesn't make sense. That's not, I'm not convinced. So, you know, I just feel like it's never wasted to try to get people to think a little bit differently. I take advantage of most media opportunities that I have to sort of get the message out. Like, it doesn't have to be this way, but...
Well, especially when there is, as you said, such a concerted... bad-spirited attempt on the other side of the issue to be divisive and to paint trans people in a negative light.
Oh, yeah. And literally what those movements are saying is the kids should be dead, not trans. Like, it's better that the kids die than be trans, because they know that, I mean, you don't always go, well, you know, kids are going to commit suicide and stuff like that, because trans youth are so much more than that. But the thing is, we know it's true. We know that the more hostile their environments, the worse trans kids do, and we know that the more supportive their environments are, the better they do. And if trans kids are supported, like, they are just as likely to thrive as cisgender kids are. It's just, you know, are they supported?
Well, and I mean, just sort of going back to what you said, for all kids, if the better supported they are, the better the outcome is, right? And so it's just agreeing that trans kids are kids, right? And they deserve that as well.
Yeah. But most kids don't get that, you know, I mean, and it doesn't make any sense, because, if you know, you can do this, like, really quick calculation about how much it costs to provide stable housing, you know, adequate nutrition, childcare, the kind of support, as opposed to the usual, which is that kids who are marginalized are disproportionately likely to end up in the prison system or in the criminal justice system, which is really, really expensive. We know that the cost of trauma multiplies in healthcare, etc. So, you know, we know what to do, but there is just too much greed and too much investment in having more than others to make that possible right now. But oh well.
Well, thanks for taking the time
to
chat
with me.
And make sure to check out the roundtable discussion tomorrow, Wednesday, April 9th, 2S LGBTQI+ youth. Challenges, Resilience, and Empowerment. That happens at SFU Harbor Center, room 1520, tomorrow, Wednesday, April 9th, at SFU Harbor Center. You can go to events.sfu.ca and find the event there, and there's a link to reserve your ticket. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, and we're now going to hear from house guest, a local indie rock group. This track is called Divine Creation and is about the trans experience. Divine Creation, this from their Bandcamp. Divine Creation is about you and it is about me. It is about remaking yourself in the image you have chosen, even in the face of powerful institutional opposition. It is about standing up and being who you are, but more importantly, it is about the freedom for anyone and everyone to follow in your footsteps if they so choose. This, by house guest, is Divine Creation.
Ashes and from dust, and it is mine to do with them. divine creation a phantom, a rough and you.
By token talkers of the ganja, dark out all my thoughts, so you ain't even gotta wonder. Some days I'm feeling fine, I'm trying to stay above the tides. But if I'm being honest, I ain't never been a swimmer. Best believe you catch me in the best seat of a Bimmer.
Last time, oh my god, this sack recovery from last night. That shit almost had me in my brain. It's not the last time, do they call it butterfly effect? I'm underground already. Cause she don't never seen the end. Who she really so insightful? Dare I say even delightful? Who'd have thought her heart, she'd always been a little timid. Never been the one to start what she could never finish. She's that girl, she really rock 'em. Go till she forgets a problem. So fucked up so she can more fucked up. Party don't start just cause the sun woke up. Past time, oh my god, this sack recovery from last night. That shit almost had me in my brain. It's not the last time, do they call it butterfly effect?
Butterfly away, butterfly, butterfly away, butterfly, 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 bye bye.